Welcome to the debate. Imagine your mother is sitting in a hospital waiting room with a subtle yet deadly case of sepsis.
Oh, okay. A terrifying scenario right off the bat.
Right. And the formal triage algorithm, which scores patients based on these, you know, very rigid criteria, it completely misses the urgency of her condition.
Which happens more often than people like to admit.
It really does. So you are faced with two choices. Wait patiently in the official queue and risk her deteriorating, or pick up your phone and text your friend who happens to be the chief of surgery to get her a bed immediately. What do you do?
Well, I mean, most people would send the text without a second thought. It is a completely understandable, deeply human act of, you know, just trying to save someone you love.
It is understandable. But that single text message exposes a massive hidden architecture operating beneath the surface of our medical institutions.
Yeah.
Today, we are diving into the 2026 academic white paper by Dr. Bachara Saley, which examines this exact phenomenon through two incredibly important concepts, healthcare enclosure and the shadow access system.
And the entire paper is actually catalyzed by an incident exactly like the one you just described.
Yes.
A physician successfully utilizing a professional messaging group to secure specialized attention for a hospitalized relative, which really is the perfect grounding catalyst for what we need to unpack today.
Absolutely. The central question we are debating today is what to do about this hidden architecture. Is the informal, connection-based shadow access system a mechanism of injustice that we must systematically dismantle?
Right.
Or is it an essential survival mechanism keeping struggling health systems afloat?
And that is the core tension.
Exactly. My position is that this shadow system drives institutional self-consumption and profound inequality. And because of that, we must structurally shift to formalize these pathways into a life-coherent architecture based entirely on care by right.
Okay. And my position is that in health systems facing severe logistical and fiscal constraints, hyper-formalizing these informal networks will just cause bureaucratic paralysis. This borrowed capacity is a necessary adaptive survival mechanism. You know, you can't simply legislate it away without catastrophic consequences.
Well, let's start by unpacking what healthcare enclosure actually means, because it really challenges our standard assumptions.
It does.
When most of us hear the word enclosure or privatization, we picture a legal transaction, right? Like a private equity firm buying a public hospital.
Right. A literal change of ownership.
Exactly. But Dr. Saley argues that enclosure happens practically, right in front of us. A hospital bed can be nominally public, funded by universal tax dollars, but your practical ability to actually get into that bed is gated by privately held capacities.
Right. And here you're talking about the six dates of practical access mentioned in the text.
I am. The paper breaks down how access isn't just about, you know, walking through the front door.
Yeah.
To actually receive treatment, a patient has to navigate six distinct gates: geographical, financial, informational, relational, institutional recognition, and finally coordinated clinical capacity.
That's a lot of hurdles.
It is. And if we just look at the informational and relational gates, so knowing how the hospital operates and knowing the people who operate it, we see how the shadow access system relies on something called differential friction.
Okay, let's pause there and explain differential friction, because it's a really fascinating concept. Friction is just systemic resistance, right?
Right.
Like an opaque referral process or a lost lab result.
Yes.
And differential means that the exact same systemic friction impacts different people in wildly unequal ways.
Ah, got it.
So let's say a hospital's formal referral software crashes constantly. For a physician trying to get their family member seen, that friction is just an annoyance. They bypass the software by sending a direct text message to a colleague.
Right, the shadow system kicks in.
Exactly. But for a patient who lacks health literacy, who doesn't speak the language well, or who has zero social capital inside the hospital, that exact same friction is life-threatening.
Yeah, it's a hard wall.
It means accumulated delay, repeated failed attempts to get an appointment, and clinical deterioration. Relying on these informal networks is structurally unjust because it protects individual lives at the cost of reproducing population-level inequity. The connected survive, the unconnected wait.
we have to transition to universal, formal navigation.
Okay, I hear you. You're calling it structurally unjust, but look at who actually survives and why. I fully concede that differential friction creates unfair realities.
Okay, good.
It is undeniably frustrating that the connected can bypass the queue, but framing the shadow access system as a malicious healthcare enclosure fundamentally misunderstands what is actually happening on the ground. We have to view this not as hoarding, but as highly efficient adaptive infrastructure.
Wait, how is bypassing a queue for the sickest patients efficient infrastructure? I mean, really?
Well, because you have to look at the environment where this is happening. This analysis is grounded in the Caribbean, and Dr. Sahili details a brilliant concept called the small numbers paradox.
Right. The scale issue.
Exactly. In a massive, well-resourced system, like in New York or London, if a critical care specialist goes on a two-week leave, the system absorbs the shock. There are 50 other specialists.
True.
But in a small island developing state, the loss of a single intensive care specialist or the breakdown of a single imported diagnostic machine doesn't just reduce capacity, it drops an entire national service to absolute zero.
Right, but wouldn't you say that extreme scarcity makes the equitable distribution of whatever capacity remains even more vital?
Ideally, yes. But you are assuming the formal system is capable of equitable distribution in a crisis. It's usually not.
Mm.
In the face of these extreme constraints, and add in geographical frictions like waiting for an inter-island ferry or relying on a nation's single working ambulance, formal pathways are incredibly slow. They are brittle.
So you just abandon them?
No, but near these tipping points, a personal call or a rapid workaround isn't corruption. It is the very expression of professional solidarity that keeps the entire system functioning. The formal system dictates that you fill out a procurement form for a broken monitor and wait 3 months for the part to clear customs.
Right.
The shadow system is a biomedical engineer calling a buddy at a private clinic and borrowing the part in 3 hours. If you eradicate this through structural formalization, you destroy the vital human flexibility that actually saves lives when rigid formal systems fail.
I mean, I understand the appeal of that flexibility, especially in the monitor example.
Yeah.
But let's look at what happens when that flexibility is applied to human beings in a waiting room. The ethical heart of acute care is triage. Triage is the formalized, democratic agreement that the sickest person gets seen first, regardless of who they are.
Right.
The shadow system fundamentally subverts triage. When a doctor texts a colleague to bump their relative up the list, clinical need is actively superseded by social capital. The person who gets the bed isn't the one who needs it most. It's the one who knows the admitting physician.
Well, you are assuming the formal triage system is perfectly omniscient, and it simply isn't. The shadow system often corrects formal failures.
Corrects them?
Yes. Triage protocols are necessary, but they can be incredibly blunt instruments. A patient might present with atypical symptoms that the formal algorithm scores as low acuity.
Okay.
The formal pathway looks at the data and says, take a seat, you're fine. It fails to recognize the acute urgency, but an insider, say a connected nurse looking at their cousin, has the health literacy to look at the patient and realize, no, the algorithm is wrong, this is subtle sepsis.
But that's still relying on a connection.
True, but their insider knowledge translates that hidden urgency into immediate action. They aren't subverting a perfect queue. They are rescuing a patient from a blind administrative protocol.
Okay, but relying on the shadow system is like navigating a sinking ship where the lifeboats are only deployed for passengers who personally know the crew.
That's a bit extreme.
Is it? It might be an adaptive survival strategy for the connected, but it structurally abandons the marginalized. How can we possibly tolerate a healthcare model where a lack of social capital practically equates to a lack of care?
I'm not saying we tolerate it.
The counterfactual presented in the paper is haunting. What happens to the exact same patient with the exact same subtle sepsis who doesn't have a nurse for a cousin? They deteriorate in the waiting room because nobody was there to translate their urgency into action.
Look, that is a tragedy of a broken system. I agree. But your solution is to ban the lifeboats.
No, my solution is to build more lifeboats for everyone.
The paper proposes a metric called the Shadow Access Dependency Index. The purpose of measuring this dependency isn't to punish the people who use workarounds or to penalize the clinicians deploying the lifeboats.
Okay, then what is it for?
It's to recognize that informal networks are providing essential orientation and escalation. They are performing functions that rigid administrative protocols fundamentally cannot replicate.
Mm-hmm. The shadow system acts as a real-time diagnostic of exactly where the formal system is failing. If you just outlaw the workarounds without fixing the underlying ship, everyone drowns equally. Is perfectly equitable drowning the goal here?
Of course not, and that's a mischaracterization of structural reform. The ship is sinking precisely because of what fuels this shadow system in the first place.
How so?
Let's shift our narrative away from the patient in the waiting room for a moment and look at the workforce desperately trying to keep this vessel afloat. Dr. Sahali introduces a vital formula, the healthcare viability gap.
Right. The gap between what is needed and what can be sustainably provided.
Yes, but let's break down the actual mechanism. The formula is legitimate patient need plus avoidable system friction exceeds the sustainably renewable capacity of the institution.
Okay.
Sustainably renewable capacity means a doctor working a normal shift, having the actual tools they need, and going home to rest. When the need exceeds that capacity, a gap opens up. And how are health systems currently filling that viability gap? They are filling it with borrowed capacity.
You mean unpaid labor, extended shifts, doctors skipping lunch?
Unpaid labor, skipping meals, but also family members acting as full-time nurses at the bedside because the ward is understaffed. And yes, those informal insider workarounds that require doctors to be on call to their social network 24/7. This creates a massive ethical load transfer.
That's a heavy phrase. Let's unpack what ethical load transfer actually looks like on the ward.
It means the institution administrators don't have the resources to provide care, so they transfer the moral burden downward to the frontline worker. The system says, we can't afford another nurse, so you figure it out.
Right.
The clinician is the one who has to look the suffering patient in the eye. This drives moral injury. We aren't just talking about physical burnout from working too many hours.
It's deeper than that.
Exactly. Moral injury is the profound psychological trauma of knowing exactly what care is ethically required, but being structurally prevented from providing it. This reliance on borrowed capacity inevitably leads to institutional self-consumption. We are quite literally cannibalizing our own workforce to meet today's metrics, which is driving mass migration of healthcare workers out of the Caribbean and out of the profession entirely.
The attrition is undeniable. But you are ignoring the compassion paradox.
The compassion paradox?
Yes. The paradox is that healthcare survives globally precisely because professionals do more than their formal roles require. The formal administrative system is just a skeleton. Human compassion is the muscle.
But that muscle is tearing.
I know, but you are arguing against borrowed capacity. If you eliminate it in a system that lacks the resources to expand its formal capacity, you will cause immediate operational collapse.
So we just keep exploiting them?
You cannot just command a resource-starved hospital to stop relying on the extra effort of its staff when there is literally no money in the national budget to hire more staff.
But don't you see that by celebrating this compassion paradox, you're normalizing chronic self-sacrifice?
I wouldn't call it celebrating.
If we treat professional generosity as an inexhaustible, unmeasured resource, aren't we guaranteeing the permanent depletion of the workforce? Leaders are given a free pass. The system appears functional on paper only because nurses and doctors are donating their conscience and their physical health to cover up the viability gap. We are borrowing against a future we are actively destroying.
Well, I don't disagree that it is destructive in the long term, but what about the short term?
What do you mean?
In an island environment where the next available specialist is a 3-hour flight away, adaptive realism is absolutely required. You call it institutional self-consumption. I call it keeping the patient breathing today. When a system is starved of resources, human connection and informal networks are the only shock absorbers left.
Which brings us to evaluating the actual feasibility of the paper's proposed path forward. This is where we look at structural transformation versus your adaptive realism.
Okay, let's get into the solutions.
The white paper doesn't just diagnose this self-consumption. It proposes a life-coherent framework. It demands distributed responsibility. The core argument is that we must formally universalize these navigation functions. If insider access provides orientation, urgency recognition, and escalation for the connected, then those functions must become a universal structural right for everyone.
What does that actually look like in practice, though?
It looks like formal patient navigation services, clear, transparent escalation pathways, real-time coordination centers where a patient without health literacy can get the exact same guidance that a doctor's cousin gets over a text message. We have to systematically eliminate the necessity of rescue by connection. The architecture of care must guarantee treatment as a right, not as a favor granted by a shadow network.
Well, that sounds beautiful in an academic seminar room, but let me introduce the implementation paradox. The paper explicitly warns about the danger of reform theater.
Reform theater being the illusion of change without the substance.
Exactly. You mandate formal navigation. You create new steering committees. You draft comprehensive escalation policies. But if you do all of that without addressing the underlying clinical shortages, you are merely creating new administrative choke points.
But highly trained formal navigator cannot navigate a patient into an ICU bed that literally does not exist. A formalized escalation pathway is completely useless if there is no intensive care specialist available in the country to escalate the case to.
I'm not saying we ignore the clinical shortage. The implementation paradox shows that adding bureaucratic layers to manage extreme scarcity just formalizes the delay. It takes away the only flexible tool clinicians had, the shadow system, and replaces it with a waiting room that has better signage.
Adding a formal navigator doesn't inherently create a choke point, though. It distributes the friction equitably and prevents the marginalized from falling through the cracks.
But equity of suffering shouldn't be the policy goal. Instead of dismantling the shadow system through bureaucratic formalization, we should prioritize the paper's brilliant suggestions for regional cooperation and pooled capacity.
Oh, I agree with regional pooling.
Right. Shared specialist networks across different island nations, regional stockpiles of critical equipment, reciprocal transfer agreements that aren't bogged down by borders. We need to build actual, tangible life capacity rather than writing new rules about how to stand in line for resources that aren't there.
Well, pooled capacity and structural reform are not mutually exclusive. In fact, they are the two hands of the life coherent framework. Regional cooperation is exactly how we build the sustainably renewable capacity I'm talking about.
Okay, fair point.
But think about the mechanics of human behavior. Even if we pooled capacity across borders, if we do not build a formal, strictly equitable mechanism for distributing that capacity, the shadow system will simply scale up.
Scale up how?
The most powerful connected individuals will just hoard the regional stockpile instead of the local one. The text message will just go to a chief of surgery on a neighboring island.
Well, that assumes the formal administrators controlling the new structural pathways are somehow immune to influence, which history tells us they are not.
Obviously, corruption can happen anywhere.
Often the shadow system is a direct reaction to formal bureaucratic hoarding. People use informal networks because the formal system is perceived as opaque and untrustworthy.
That's a cynical view of public administration.
It's a realistic one in heavily constrained environments. But I will concede this. The life coherent frameworks focus on the regenerative loop. You know, the cycle of protect, detect, respond, restore, learn, and renew is essential. We absolutely have to renew the workforce we are currently consuming, or there won't be anyone left to text.
Exactly. Let me summarize my position as we look at the whole picture. Healthcare enclosure is a profound ethical failure.
Right.
When a nominally public, universal system relies on private capacities, whether that is personal wealth, specialized knowledge, status, or inside connections to actually function, it ceases to be public. We must stop relying on the compassion paradox to paper over our systemic failures.
Mm-hmm.
Institutional self-consumption is an existential threat to the workforce. We have to structurally formalize access, universalize navigation, and guarantee care by right rather than crossing our fingers and hoping a patient happens to know a doctor on the inside.
And my position remains that while true equity is the ultimate noble goal, demonizing or rapidly dismantling the shadow access system in heavily constrained environments removes a vital layer of resilience.
Yeah.
The small numbers paradox dictates that formal systems in these regions will inevitably face tipping points. And when they do, human flexibility is all we have left to save lives. True viability won't come from punishing informal networks or adding restrictive administrative layers. It will come from pooling tangible regional capacity and trusting clinicians to adapt.
I think where we fundamentally converge today is our recognition of the sheer danger of the status quo.
Oh, absolutely.
the healthcare viability gap is at a precarious, potentially terminal tipping point. The current reliance on ethical load transfer, you know, forcing frontline nurses and doctors to absorb the moral injury of a deeply broken system, is driving an unsustainable level of workforce attrition. We are losing the very people required to care for us.
We are. And we both completely recognize that the constraints of the small numbers paradox demand serious structural attention, whether that is achieved through regional cooperation or massive, unprecedented reinvestment. The current system is quite literally eating itself to survive the day.
It really is. The profound complexity here is figuring out how to transition a health system from a culture of heroic rescue to a culture of dependable reliability.
That's the million-dollar question.
How do we build a structural architecture so robust and reliable that heroism is no longer a daily requirement while ensuring we don't lose that beautiful adaptive core of human solidarity in the process? That tension between equitable structure and adaptive resilience requires ongoing rigorous exploration.
It is the defining challenge of a generation for health policy, not just in the Caribbean, but globally.
Indeed. We'll leave the ultimate judgment on how to balance systemic reform with operational reality to you, the listener. But the next time you walk into a hospital lobby, look past the official triage signs and ask yourself, who actually built the floorboards here? And who knows how to navigate the hidden wiring underneath? Until next time.